God bless Africa, guard her children, guide her leaders. God bless Africa and give her peace. God bless Africa, guard her children, guide her leaders. God bless Africa and give her peace. In most churches, at least the churches that we ever worshipped at in South Africa, every Sunday this prayer was prayed at the end of the service, the blessing, and then the people prayed the prayer. And it always kept in mind our needing to ask God for blessings for the land and for its leaders. And leaders referring to all of the people, black and white, whether they are elected or, you know, in power or whatever. There are many leaders who needed our prayers, so maybe we'll sing it at the end again too. Does anybody need this connection for hearing, or if you find that as I begin and you can't hear well enough, then please let me know so that I can put this little machine on and you can hook up and you can make it a little easier. It's nice to have you join me again, and it's nice for me to be able to share with you a little of a variety of subjects this week with you about our time in South Africa. For those who haven't been before, I'm Joyce Soldner. We lived 5 years in South Africa, working with the people there and as missionaries. We've been back a year, but at the moment we are in transition, and my husband is already, probably right about this point, in Namibia, and I will be joining him with one of my daughters toward the end of the month. But today I'd like to talk to you a little bit and share some information on the women and their struggle in South Africa. I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but 1988 to 1998 has been declared the ecumenical decade of women, working for solidarity, justice, and development. Now, it is a very important time for the people, and especially the women of South Africa, because the rights of the women in that land are extremely limited. I have a t-shirt that I wore frequently as I made my way around the city that's had the words across the back, churches in solidarity with women. And it was amazing how many comments. In one shopping center I met a woman working in one of the shops who, a white woman who was a Methodist woman, and was very pleased to see that t-shirt. Many times around the city I had people stop me, women, and speak about that, and were happy, or I got smiles of approval for letting that message be known to the people.
Is there. In Seattle or in Africa?
This was in South Africa. I don't know. I haven't seen them here. Probably not. Mm-hmm. I actually feel very inadequate speaking for the women of Southern Africa. I can only speak of my experience with them and give you my impressions and some of the experiences that I had while living there. During our first 2 years in South Africa, we were very closely working with the Lutheran Church there. And there's the organization that some of you may have seen in some of the slides that I showed of the prayer women, the Women's League, that were an important part of that church. And all of the churches had their prayer women. The black women would meet every Thursday afternoon, and you would know the church by the uniforms they wore. I mean, the Methodists had these beautiful red tops with white collars and white hats and black skirts. The Lutheran women were in black and white. So you knew the the church denomination by the uniform that you saw the women, and the women wore them very proudly. And I became a part of that, being the pastor's wife. I also became a member of the prayer women and could wear wore their uniform and was considered their mother. I didn't feel right, actually, in that role, but I was considered their mother. The last 3 years there, I expanded my my association with women to women of all denominations in the work that I did, and I came to really understand the really deep struggle that the women throughout the country were dealing with. A lot of them I met as I worked with the detainee office, dealing with keeping records of young people who were in detention, and the mothers, the women would come there seeking information on their sons or their daughters. And so through that, I really came to feel the pain and the struggle of the women and what they lived with each day. I remember a mother coming in there at one point whose son was in detention, but there was a country a hunger strike started by detainees in Cape Town, and it spread throughout the country that it was a way of protesting their being held in prison without any charges or any trials. And a mother came into the office where I was working and sat and cried because she said, "I know how strongly my son feels about the issues in this land, and he will fast, he will be on hunger strike until he dies." And so it's the pain that the women feel throughout throughout the country that I can speak to you about, but I didn't experience it in that way. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the history. In April of 1954, the Federation of South African Women was formed. Now, the object of forming it was that because women felt, now this was in 54, the women felt at that point that it was high time they took their role seriously as women, as mothers, and it was formed specifically to guard against the injustices in their homes and in their families and with their children. And to start with, a few women organized and drew together women from a variety of organizations like the ANC's Women's League, Colored People's Congress, Indian Congress, Congress of Democrats. They got a lot of trade union representatives of women. They brought together women teachers involved with sports, with the churches. And they formed an organization which then, in early 56, decided to call a conference. And they decided they had to choose a way or find a way that they could speak publicly about the concerns that they had. And so they decided that August 9th was going to be set as their day. And what they did was they gathered petitions of protest against actually, at this point, they chose the passes that people had to carry, the pass laws where they had to present, if they were stopped anywhere, they had to present a passbook that told exactly who they were, where they were from, a lot of information. If they didn't have it on them, then they were put in prison. So this was their first means of protest. So they got all these petitions signed, and on August 9th, they gathered, and they were going to march to the Prime Minister's, at that time was Strydom, in Pretoria to the Union Buildings. And they worked hard to gather all these petitions together. And as they were gathering, the announcement came to them from the higher-ups that their protest was an illegal gathering and they were not allowed to do it. But the women decided they weren't going to stop. They decided to gather two by two. They couldn't go in large groups, so they marched two by two, carrying their petitions to the Union Building. And as they gathered there, they found that Stratum had locked his doors and disappeared, and they could not face him face to face. But they left all of their petitions there at the door, and they came back to people who didn't make the whole march, gave a report, and after that sang the national anthem, and then dispersed. And ever since that time, August 9th has become a very important time. It's celebrated as this special day that these women made their formal protest against the injustices in that land, and they did it as women marching to Pretoria. Well, in celebration of that day, several years ago, the women of South Africa wrote a creed, and I'd like to share that with you. And it's free of the traditional language that portrays God as all male. And for the women of South Africa to come out and to declare a creed like this is a real big step. It goes like this. I believe in God, who created woman and man in God's own image, who created the world and gave both sexes the care of the earth. I believe in Jesus, child of God, chosen of God, born of the woman Mary, who listened to women and liked them, who stayed in their homes, who discussed the kingdom with them, who was followed and financed by women disciples. I believe in Jesus, who discussed theology with a woman at a well, and first confided in her his messiahship, who motivated her to go and tell her great news to the city. I believe in Jesus, who received anointing from a woman in Simon's house, who rebuked the men guests who scorned her. I believe in Jesus, who said this woman will be remembered for what she did, minister for Jesus. I believe in Jesus, who healed a woman on the Sabbath and made her straight because she was a human being. I believe in Jesus, who spoke of God as a woman seeking the lost coin, as a woman who swept seeking the lost. I believe in Jesus, who thought of pregnancy and birth with reverence, not as punishment, but as retching event, a metaphor for transformation, born again, anguish into joy. I believe in Jesus, who spoke of himself as a mother hen who would gather her chicks under her wing. I believe in Jesus, who appeared first to Mary Magdalene, who sent her with the bursting message, "Go and tell." I believe in the wholeness of the Savior, in whom there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for we are all one in salvation. I believe in the Holy Spirit as she moves over the waters of creation and over the earth. I believe in the Holy Spirit, the women's spirit of God, who like a hen created us and gave us birth and covers us with her wings.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful statement of their belief, and speaks for in a very special way from the women of Southern Africa. But you know, I wonder, I'd like to share too, what brought women to the point of having to march in that land and to speak out, to risk their life and declare a creed like this. The history of women in South Africa goes back about 100 years ago. Most African women lived in rural areas with their husbands, with their families. And they worked plowing the land together and growing crops and caring for their children and providing the things that they needed for their families and for their homes. But in 1886, gold was discovered in the Transvaal area, which is around in the Johannesburg area, Pretoria area. And the mining industry and the towns started to grow and very fast, so that the men who were in the rural areas before found themselves moving then to the city to become part of this mining migrant labor system. Now, the women and the children were supposed to remain in the rural areas and take care of things there while the men then went to work in the mines. And if a woman wanted to go to the towns or the cities to visit either her husband or even to go there and work, it was a very difficult thing, and she had to get special permission, and permission wasn't granted very readily. So at first, the black women remained in the rural areas while the men went off to the cities, but slowly they began to come to town to work or to join their husbands to be there. But it was this happened probably around the 1930s that things began to change. And then life in the rural areas became difficult. It became overcrowded. The soil became bad. There wasn't a lot of good soil for growing crops or whatever they needed to provide for their families. So the women realized that it was time for them to have to go to the city also. This meant that the children that were in those rural areas were then taken care of a lot of times by the grandparents, grandmothers, or the older children had to remain there and care for the children. And it caused separation of families, because then the mother was gone, the father was gone. So the extended family really had to care for the family. The industry was growing so that the African men were able to get jobs in the factories. And so the jobs they were originally doing, some of the women then that came could come to the city and work. They worked like as washerwomen, domestic workers who they worked for families, doing laundry, cleaning, cooking. They come in and look for peace jobs sometimes too. I remember people coming to our door asking for peace jobs, just little jobs. But they would go there because it was their only hope of making some money, because they weren't doing well in the rural areas. So then the men then got jobs in the factories. By about 1980 though, then there were more jobs even available in factories for women. So then by that time there were about 43 out of every 100 workers were women in the factories. Now the problem with all of that was that work in the factories was very tough work. It involved a lot of hard labor. And I think the best way to know about that sort of thing is to share a story, an interview from a woman who came from the rural areas and came to the city and then became working in the factories. And I'd like to read a little bit about it, because I think it not only talks about her problems, it's a story of many women in the same situation. And it also shows what it involves for a woman striving for a better life, what she has to go through, what she has to suffer. This is the story of Nomvula. I've been doing night work for about 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. Now I'm cleaning an office building. I start work at 6 o'clock at night and work through till 3 o'clock or half past 3. There are 60 of us in the different office buildings. In my building, we are 4. This work is not good for a woman. When we knock off, it is dangerous, and we go into the street. There are so many tsotsis. Those are called the little troublemakers, I guess. And there's no transport, so we have to try and sleep till morning, and there's nowhere to sleep. In the daytime, it's also hard to sleep because sometimes it's hot and there's a lot of noise in the location. The location is where they live, the township areas. The people leave those offices very dirty. There's paper everywhere and sometimes even cigarettes on the floor. It's dirty. That is why we work the whole night. And we've got to clean the toilets as well. Each one of us has a whole floor to do, and that floor is big. On my floor, I've got 5 toilets and 2 kitchens, and these toilets are so huge inside, you could put your bed and your wardrobe there and make it a room. Every time I clean in the same way, you must start with emptying the dustbins and ashtrays. Then you dust, and you must dust the pictures on the walls, clean them nicely. After that, you hoover the carpets in the machine with the machine, and there's a huge big buffing machine for the floors. On Fridays, you must put polish in the toilets and on the stairways and the furniture. Friday is too much work. Those machines are so heavy, sometimes you have terrible backache and your hands are tired. The machines are for men, really. When you've finished your work, you go downstairs to wash the dusting rags and clean the machines. Once we've finished, we wash ourselves and we sleep there until about 5:30. We sleep in our changing rooms. The place is sometimes very cold. There's no carpet on the floor, only tiles. You just take cardboard boxes and sleep on the floor. Sometimes you sit in the chair and you sleep sitting like this because it's cold on the floor. Or you turn on the hot plate to warm the room. After sleeping, we wash ourselves again and we walk to the station. This is the train station or the taxi place. It's still dangerous then, but if we sleep till 7:30, we reach Soweto at 9:00, and that's too late. People with children have to be there to prepare food for them and help them get ready for school. In winter, you know, you must come and make sure the children have got warm jerseys and all that. I am luckier because my mother does that job for me. I just have to go home and sleep. So we get home at 7:00 or 7:30. Then I sleep at about 8:30. At midday, I wake up because I must make the fire and cook. Then I must wash myself and prepare to catch a 2:00 bus, which takes me back to the station. The station is too far, and the trains are few at that time of the day. If I miss my bus, I am late for work. I used to live with my mother in Meadowlands, which is one of the areas of Soweto. It has a two-roomed house, and I've got my own 4 children and my brother's children as well. We were 9 altogether, and the toilet is inside. If that toilet is blocked, you've got to stay outside. The house was too small. We were sleeping from the kitchen to the dining room. It was not comfortable for us sleeping on the floor. Now, this happens to be a woman whose family has come with her there. There are many others who don't, though. Now, it's better because we've got our place, my husband and I. It's a backyard room. We pay 60 rand a month. It's too much for only a two-roomed house. You must just fit in your bed and your wardrobe. My children stay at my mother's. I try to go every weekend to see my children and take them some food. I miss them, but I've got no choice because they can't sleep there alone at night. You see, my husband is also working at night. He's a security guard in the same company as me. My husband gets home at about 8 in the morning because he knocks off at 6. When he comes, he sleeps because he's got no children to wash. He just sleeps, and he sometimes wakes up at 1:00 and I give him food. He doesn't help at home, huh? She laughs, because you know they say that a husband is a big man. He shouldn't do anything at home. The woman must work. We both work at night, but he can't help me with anything. When he's at home, he must have a rest, and I must cook for him. He thinks if his friends find him sweeping, they're going to say he's stupid. So he can't do anything. He just sits there with the paper. On the weekends, there's lots to do at home, with your washing and ironing. Clean the house and cook for your husband, and you go to church and you sleep at night. This job makes me sick. You've got sore eyes and you've got headaches all the time because you don't sleep full hours. Some women take snuff to keep themselves awake at work. We're taking tablets like Disprin and Compril so that we don't sleep, because you can't work when you're feeling sleepy. The tablets aren't healthy, but what can we do? We've got headaches and sore feet from standing all night, and backache from scrubbing, going up and down like that. And you've got tension, you feel dizzy. You don't know how you are, that's why you take tablets. Sometimes we just feel like leaving, but we've got no choice. If we could get easier jobs, we'd do it. But there's no work in South Africa. We must pay rent, we must feed our children. That's why we do night shift. The position of women workers is too heavy with many things. The first thing, say you are a woman and you are looking for a job. When you reach a factory, you find the Induna there and you ask him. If you like the job, the Induna will tell you that you must sleep with him before you get that job. You've got no choice. You want to work and your children are starving in Soweto. So some women sleep with these men. Some women sleep with the bosses because they want more money or easier work. They do it because they want to live, not because they're mad or what. Then when you are working there, a new woman comes and the Induna wants to sleep with her. And you're nothing inside now. And your husband may leave you because you've got another man's baby. And you've only slept with that man because you wanted the job. It's sick, all that. The other thing is there are a lot of domestic workers who work in homes. But the sad part about that is, in many of the situations, you know, it's a one-to-one relationship with a person working in a home and with the people in that home. But many of the employers treat their domestic workers as children who have to be disciplined and treat them in such oppressive ways. And the women as domestic workers haven't in the past had a lot of control over that. They didn't have organizations. They didn't have ways if they were treated badly to go anyplace to have help with that. It's changing in some ways. But for instance, this woman said here, her name was Stephanie, "I once worked for a very unkind woman. She'd like to come and show you when you hadn't cleaned well," pointed out. "And the food, I can't speak about the food. Any cupboard she used to lock. Sometimes she forgot the keys and left them in the lock when she went to work. Then she'd phone home and say, 'Oh, Stephanie, please call one of my children and tell them to hide the keys away.' I'd just look and say, 'Hi.'" So it's that relationship that's there with women, workers, that really doesn't give them much dignity or leaves them in a very, very difficult position. You know, just when you think about our lives or your lives, raising children or just even now, existing, supporting a family, making a living, all of those stresses and responsibilities that go along with that are enough to wear us all out. And then you get women who, South African women who are struggling not only with those issues, but with so much more. You can imagine the stress and the struggles that they go through. And then you add to that women who find themselves wanting to get involved in the struggle, getting politically active, or who have children who are politically active, maybe who have lost children. You see what they are living with and the pain and the struggle in that society. And it becomes a difficult burden for them. You know, when I was there, I have continued to keep in touch with people and women, especially involved in the struggle. And I think I'd like to share a couple of other things that I think give you the feel for what women are living with and struggling with. This one, every time I read it, I have a difficult time reading it because it's sad. It's so sad. But this is a story that was in the New York Times about a woman. It is about South Africa and New York City, about a son and a mother. Imagine this, image one. A mother at an airport saying goodbye to her 26-year-old son. The son is a photographer fleeing his native land, South Africa. He has taken searing pictures of what apartheid is doing to his people. If the authorities found the photos, they would do very bad things to him. The son's goal was to show them to the world. The mother sees tears in his eyes. Image two. The son is now 49 years old, dying of stomach cancer in New York Hospital. On TV, he watches Nelson Mandela walk in the sunlight, a free man. He is in pain, but he forces a smile. Indeed, there is a growing calmness in this exile's eyes, a new serenity after years of nervously wandering the margins of America's biggest city. Now, image three, a sitting room in the same hospital 5 days later. The son has painfully twisted himself into a wheelchair to greet the mother, now 81. They have not seen each other in a quarter century. She enters, weak from air sickness. "Mommy, please don't cry," the son says in Afrikaans. The next day, Ernest Cole would lapse into senselessness. The day after that, February 18th, he would die. Then would come a funeral where hymns were sung in Sotho, his first language. Later, South African expatriates would gather and voice the hope that Ernest's life would be scattered like seeds. And last night, Martha Cole, Ernest's mother, boarded an airplane for the second time in her life to return to a black township and her lovely flower garden. She carried House of Bondage, which was a collection of Ernest's photographs, the crowning achievement of a too short life. She had never seen it. But again, it tells that the grief of a mother And then I got a letter from another woman. Those of you who saw, were in my session, was it last night? I'm getting my days totally mixed up. Where I showed the young people in Walter Cronkite's, he spoke out against his treatment. But this is a letter from his mother and the pain she was feeling. Dear Joyce, hello dear, I hope you have received my card, hoping that it reached you in a good condition. Joyce, what I can say to you as a woman who has chosen the cross, I hope that this will not surprise you. Please, please, my dear, I'm giving you a task. It is a heavy one, to remember me whenever you pray, and also to ask other women to tell them to pray for me. I'm facing a heavy job. I'm starting to work for my son's tombstone. It's hard, but I always put my trust in God, and I know He is going to help me. He always helps me, my dear. You know, my health is even worse now because, you see, I see the doctor twice a month for high blood pressure, nerves, and depression, but I hope to survive till my prayers are answered. How is your family? Mine is fine. My two little girls have passed their examinations very well, and the only thing which worries me is we don't get along well, me and my husband. Since my son died, he is blaming me for his death. He says I should have stopped my son from what he was doing. And again, he says if my son was not asked to do the film Children of Apartheid, he should have been with us today. But I still say his death has opened my eyes. I did not know anything about oppression. I used to say everything is okay as long as I'm living. So long, my love. Give my love to your family. Sylvia. Now a child, the death of her child, opened her eyes. As painful as it was, to speaking out against oppression. Not only was she suffering oppression, as all the women of being a black, but also being a woman, and the struggles that a woman goes through. But the women of South Africa are amazing. They're amazing because in the midst of their struggles, in the midst of all of the grief and the loss, they are people who don't abandon hope. And they are working. I mean, for instance, there are some examples here where women are now mobilizing themselves against mass evictions and forced removals. They're working in the homes of white families and living in backyards in so-called white areas. They've come together as domestic workers also to fight long hours, and they've organized themselves into organizations to not put up with all the junk that's laid in front of them or that they have to feel. As head of households, in many cases, they've taken decisions to support rent boycotts. They've boycotted in the townships against the high rent that keeps getting put onto them, and consumer boycotts. It's amazing what the black population, especially the women who do the shopping, can, if they do not agree with something, they can boycott certain stores. They do not buy there, and it puts a crunch on the economy when they do those kinds of things, and they are doing that. Women students and girls in high school have stood in solidarity with their male counterparts in class boycotts in support of demanding democratic control of education, non-discriminatory conditions for learning. They have campaigned against men for an end to systems of military conscription for young white men. And there are growing groups of white women too. You've probably heard of the group the Black Sash, who it's a white organization of women who are strongly opposed to the whole system and speaking out against apartheid. They also run a center. I lost the name of it. I mean, it's just a place in Johannesburg where people can come and get help with housing problems, with people treat them badly with their work. These women then contact businesses and are go-betweens for the people So you've got black and white women who are really working together to change the whole system there and to try to bring just equality and a good life for the people there. So that they continue. The women continue to sing and dance and laugh and hug and love, and the biggest thing that I think they do that is hard to imagine sometimes is forgive. To be forgiving and loving and caring, even to the people that treat them with such inhumanity. So I think it's important for us to daily hold them up in prayer, just as Sylvia asked us in that letter, to pray for them, to wherever there are chances for you to speak to your congresspeople, wherever you are across the country, to speak for justice for the people, and I'm speaking especially at this point for the women, I think it's important for you to do, and that's how you can be of help. But I also think it's equally important for you to be support for the women in this land. And in working in that way, we are working for justice for people around the world. There's one other thing I wanted to share, and then we'll take a few moments if we want to talk about things. And something written by a black woman, but I think it speaks to all of us. It's entitled, Who Am I? I am a woman, I am black, I am alive, I am struggling, I am hoping. I am created in the image of God, just like all other people in the world. I am a person with worth and dignity. I am a thinking person, a feeling person, a doing person. I am the small I am that stands before the big I am. I am a worker who is constantly challenged and faced with the needs of the people and society and the global community. I am angered by the structures and powers that create all forms of oppression, exploitation, and degradation. I am a witness to the moans, the tears, the banners, and the clenched fists of my people. I can hear the liberating songs, their hopeful prayers, and decisive march toward justice and freedom. I believe that all of us, anywhere in this world, women and men, young and old, Christian and non-Christian, are called upon to do responsible action, to be concerned, to be involved now. I am hoping, I am struggling, I am alive, I am black, I am a woman. And I think that that's pretty much of what I've had sort of prepared to say. And if any of you would like to speak about or ask questions, if I can answer them. I don't know, there was someone who mentioned, if anybody has anything they want to say too about how you think. Someone said the other night about having the woman-to-woman exchange program with people. Whether anyone wants to speak to that too, as far as a way of relating to the women of the world too. I think that's a wonderful thing. Anything, any comments? Or
I had a question. When you read the creed, you said that they would like to have children because they wanted them and not because they had to.
I'm sorry, when I was aware...
When you read the creed?
Oh, yes.
His creed. What's the average number of children for the women over there? And is the birth control available for them?
You know, I actually don't have facts and figures on that. I do know the death rate of children is so vast that having children is such an important thing. Having family and children is important, and I think part of having a lot of children is the fact that they know that they are going to lose so many too, and the amount of children they have. I can't give you quotes on. I don't know. Do you have any? Do you have in the past? I really don't have that on the rate of births. I just know that the deaths are so vast because of the what's so hard to imagine. I mean, you look at South Africa, you look at, it's a wealthy, wealthy country. You've got the most highest standard of living of whites, I think, in the world is in South Africa, among the whites there. And you've got, but you've also got one of the highest rates of malnutrition and deaths of children and hunger and poverty. And a lot of this is out in the rural areas where, and that brings up the point where you've got in the Natal area, which is Zululand, controlled by Ngata Buthelezi, there you've got, even though he is, you know, a wealthy ruler, the people in his area, in that part of the country, are also where you've got the highest rate of poverty and hunger among the people in the rural areas.
A trait that you find in the third world nations, and I think you would, because you did mention that when you were describing the women and the outlook, is that they can almost laugh at tragedy and suffering, and immediately they start the healing process.
Mm.
And they don't grieve for long. They grieve along with their healing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful thing to have.
And they grieve together. And they,
right,
and
right.
They are such, that's another idea, I mean, the thought of community. They are such a community that they grieve together and they hold each other up and they then go on.
Yeah.
And that's this prayer women that I would thought of that so often when the prayer women would come together on their afternoons to pray and to sing. That's one of the things they would, if anybody had something that they were grieving, that was their time to speak it and then they'd all pray together about it and they'd help, you know, they were like just a wonderful, loving, caring community for each other. I'm sorry, I think you had some more to say.
Basically that, and all the correspondence I get, it gets me that, and which is, we need it. They're the ones that are suffering, at least materially, the wise way, and they say, we're praying for you, Bill.
Yes, that's true.
The irony of that.
And we need that.
We do need that.
Yeah.
The irony of that, that when you said that, is that it's a tragedy.
Yes.
And the tragedy is that they do it so well because they've done it so long and so often. We don't know how to grieve in the same way because we don't have to live with the same kind of constant grief.
Yeah.
So while it's something that leads to us a sense of wonderment and how can we be that way? The tragedy is that they have to make it communal. They have to learn to grieve and to be hopeful at the same time or they would never survive.
Because their life is so basic. And you never hear one of them say, well, I can never get over this. I will grieve on this.
Because they know they can. Because they have. They always will. But they won't say that they always will.
Right.
That's
right.
The other irony that you I worked closely with Namibian students kind of for the 2 years prior to independence and now. And the thing that I had noticed when I would be speaking or Americans that I knew would be speaking about the issue of Namibia was if Namibia is free. And the students never said that.
If.
It's when.
When.
And I think the same for that. One thing that I just love, a friend of Joyce's and mine, and Jim Knudsen, who was the area secretary for Southern Africa and lived in South Africa for 18 years as a missionary. He always likes to use the description that not just he but others of women in Africa at large. Is that the women, when you see a picture of women in Africa, you see a large bowl on their heads and a baby on their back, and it's the women that carry the economy on their head and the future on their backs. And it's an image that's incredible, but it's also so painful. Those stories you read, Joyce, just bring tears. It just chills.
Yeah.
That brings attention to a wonderful book to read. If you know, there's I heard an owl call my name.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, I've been really poor about books. I get up here and I forget to tell you. But I mean, if anybody would like to look through this, I need to have this back. It's called Working Women. It's not in the, I don't think it's in the bookstore, but it's a wonderful story of, I mean, it's not wonderful. It tells you the lives of women and what they involved in. The other thing is that I just have a copy of this, this one here was published, actually, Woman's Place is in the Struggle, Not Behind Bars. This was put out, and then by the DPSC, which is Detainee Parent Support Committee, they had just printed all of this up. And it tells about, I don't think it's anything you can get here at all. I brought it with me. But it's, then the government at that point banned this organization. And so they had all these things ready to put out. And then they had to redo the acknowledgments in the front and change who had done it, so that then it was kind of distributed quietly and carefully around. That's the way they had to get things out, you know. And so, but it also has some very interesting stories. Actually, I was so surprised here. I saw this picture in here. This is this is Sylvia. Actually, this is Sylvia who I read, and here's another picture of her that I put on, I laminated. But here I found out this picture was taken and I was sitting right next to her. And I didn't realize, this picture came out, I thought, that looks like my ear and my hair. And it really was. But it speaks of her son and the life, you know, what it meant to her. And so if anybody would like to look through this in the next day or so, you know, you certainly can do that, or today. And there are, take a look in the bookstore. I mean, there are other books there that have to do with South Africa and the people there. And my husband just told me, when I talked to him the last time on the phone, there is a book, it's not here now, by an Alastair Smith. The book is called The Mind of South Africa, and apparently that is the latest and the best story of what's really going on.
Is he that newspaper man?
I don't know. It sounds like there's an Alastair, somebody else who was on.
Cook?
Alastair Cook.
Yeah.
But it's not, I don't know. Alastair Smith, I'm not sure.
I was interested in the fact that you mentioned August 9th. This year, for the first time, I didn't know that, but a woman in our community got the black women together and the children on that day. Okay. And they went down and they sat at the gates of Boeing, because Boeing refuses to... that was a day of statement for the right, because they don't observe the sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you if this march ever was fruitful. Do they still have to carry those passes with
them?
No. Oh, good.
But they still are classified according to race.
Are they?
There's still that race classification.
I'm sure there must be black teachers and black nurses, but are there black women in business in South Africa? Other than domestics, are there black women in business?
I'm sure. Why, yes, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think about.
There aren't very many black men.
Well, do black women have fruit stands and things? And,
oh, yes.
Well,
that's very common. The fruit,
yeah.
The,
and the juice of one of the things.
Corn, on the street corners, yeah.
Thing that we were pointed out to us was the fact that the Coca-Cola company, those big companies, come into these countries, and then the women are out of business with their fruit, their drinking stands. Everybody wants Coca-Cola.
Well, Coca, that's the one thing.
Coca-Cola employs the black women.
I don't know.
They are employed. Certainly, they are employed in those companies and everything. I mean, everybody drinks Coke. That's why I don't drink Coke. I mean, I had a Diet Coke over here, but I only drink Pepsi. Because Coke is everywhere there. Coca-Cola is the big, big business there with cold drinks. I mean, they have other things, but and my son is the one who's strong on that too. And I was he refuses.
Various places. It's in El Salvador. It's a few other places.
It's everywhere.
Pepsi's in the Soviet Union.
Right.
Well, I thank you for coming, and if we have a chance to talk other times, I'm happy to do that. So.
Don't feel inadequate, because if you hadn't come, where would we be?
That's okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you
very much.